in this lesson. Okay. If you're joining us online on the live stream or watching this after the fact, go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under recent sermons, click on the link for November 23, and you can load the notes that I'm going to be using here in class. So we want to get right into things. There's always a lot of ground to cover. So lesson 268, assessing the printed history of the text, the King James text, American text, 1783 to 1820. So it's right in the introduction. Lesson 267, explore the early history of the King James Bible in America, focusing on its first printing on American soil. It follows up on previous discussions about British editions, particularly the 1769 Blaney Revision, and shifts attention to the American context. So that's what we did last time. We began a focus specifically on America. Okay. So the following 2 points our discussion in lesson 267. So first we talked about the colonial period. Okay. So before the American Revolution, English Bibles were imported from Britain due to the Crown's monopoly on Bible printing. So we've talked about that before. Remember, the Crown had a copyright and only Crown-approved printers could publish the text because the authority to do so was vested in the Crown. So colonial printers did not view themselves as having the latitude to do that. Second, colonial printers feared legal repercussions for unauthorized reprints, which obviously follows from the previous point. But then we also talked about the fact that there were practical challenges like cost, lack of materials, and limited demand that also hindered local printing. So there were paper issues, there was having enough typeface, there were logistical issues that also would made it difficult for the colonists to publish the text in the New World. No confirmed English Bibles were printed in the colonies before independence, though some non-English editions, example Algonquin and German, were produced. So we talked about that last time, all right? Then our second major point from last time in lesson 267 was the first American printing. This took up the bulk of our time. So during the Revolutionary War, Bible shortages prompted a petition to the Continental Congress in 1777. Congress considered printing, but ultimately opted to import Bibles due to logistical challenges. Printer Robert Aiken took initiative and printed the first English New Testament in 1777, followed by the first complete English Bible in America in 1782. Congress officially endorsed Aiken's Bible, praising its accuracy and significance, and Aiken's edition differed slightly from the standard 1769 Blaney text, and his source text remains unknown. So remember, we saw differences there where it was a mix. Historian Dr. Lawrence M. Vance says that it was a mix of Cambridge and Oxford printings, but we don't know for sure what exemplar he was using when he typeset that first American Bible. We also noted that spelling variations appeared immediately in the first American printing. We saw occurrences of established being used for stablish, and razor with a Z and razor with an S, variant spellings of razor. Okay. Top page 2. Despite his efforts, the return of British imports after the war undercut Aiken's sales, leading to financial hardship. So almost as soon as this Bible is printed, a peace is declared with the British, and this reopens up the trade, etc., that had been cut off during the war, and Bibles from the mother country again start to flow into the new republic. And so this is going to lead to hardship for Aiken because he cannot compete with their products as far as quality or price. Okay, and we saw lastly here that the Presbyterian Synod later purchased and distributed his Bibles to the poor. So as an act of charity to Aiken for what he had endeavored to do during the Revolution, they buy some and they use them in the distribution of them to poor people to try to help Aiken out financially. Okay. So that's a brief summary of what we saw last time as we looked at the first American printing. Okay. So just real quick, anybody had any questions, comments, feedback on that review before we get to new material here? Should be pretty straightforward. Okay. So in this lesson, we will continue to look at the American text by considering the following points. Right. So I want to look at post-revolutionary King James Bibles from 1783 to 1800. Then I want to talk about Matthew Carey's collation and editions. the impact of stereotyping in the American Bible Society, and then we want to look at the orthography or spelling of the American Bible Society text. And this is going to bring us up to about 1820 by the time we're done with looking at today's notes. Okay? So, once again, the content for this lesson was taken from my book, The King James Bible in America. That's this book right here. The King James Bible in America, an orthographic, historical, and textual investigation published by Dispensational Publishing House in 2019. So a lot of the material is taken from the book. You'll see some charts and stuff. Those are screenshots from the book. Okay. So if you want a copy of it, you can order this from gracelifepress.com. The church has copies here if you want to pick one up in person. Okay. So, let's get into the first point then, which is post-revolutionary King James Bibles, 1783 to 1800. During the 17 years between the end of the Revolution and the turn of the century, four significant editions of the King James Bible were printed in America. Now let me say this, there were more than four, but there were four fairly significant ones that were printed, right? So if you want to track the printed history of the text in America, there are two books that you're going to have to, you're going to struggle without them, okay? The first one is this one right here. This is a list of editions of the Holy Scriptures and parts thereof printed in America previous to 1860. So this is a catalog of printings in America up through the year 1860, okay? Then in 1960, exactly 100 years after that one, a woman named Margaret Hills put together the Bible in America. And this is a catalog of all of the Bibles published on American shores through 1960. Okay, so you can see that these are, you know, roughly twice as thick, etc. So this is an expansion on what had been published 100 years earlier, where they are cataloging different editions that have been published in America. Herbert's catalog catalogs more than that because it's cataloging British printings as well as American printings. Okay, and that's a whole different catalog, but I don't want to get off in too many weeds. I just want to make that known. Okay, so during the 17 years between the end of the Revolution and the turn of the century, four significant editions of the King James Bible were printed in America. They were the editions printed by Isaac Collins, 1789, Isaiah Thomas, 1791, the Brown Self-Interpreting Family Bible, also known as the Brown Folio Bible, from 1792, and Hugh Gaines from 1792. Okay, now I have scans of all of these. This is the first one here. This one is done by Isaac Collins. This is from, I'm going to get the year wrong, so I need to look. This is from 1789. Okay, this is the one done by Isaiah Thomas. Also, this one was from 1791. Okay, so here are the title pages. You can see, maybe I got these backwards. No, this is his full Bible from 1791. This one is the Brown Self-Interpreting Bible. Here's John Brown's name. If you look up the, it's faded out here, but there's some Roman numerals. It's published in New York, and this dates from 1792. And then here's the text that was published by Hugh Gain also in 1792. So you can see it's New York. Printed and sold by Hugh Gain. Okay, so these are four significant editions that are published between the Revolution, the end of the war, and the year 1800. Okay, these are arguably the four most popular editions of the text during that time frame. Okay, back to the notes. Other minor printings of the New Testament also occurred during this period. For a complete list of editions of the post-revolutionary era, interested parties are encouraged to consult Margaret T. Hills' book, The English Bible in America, a bibliography of editions of the Bible and New Testament published in America, 1777 to 1957. And again, that's this blue book right here is going to give you all that information should you be interested in looking at it. Okay. Advertisements for editions by Collins, Thomas, and Brown alarmed theologians in the newly formed Republic who were concerned with the purity and uniformity of the text. While the core text of these Bibles was the King James text of 1769, it was clear that publishers were already seeking to embellish their editions by adding ancillary material such as marginal notes, references, concordances, and the like. So do they immediately start to cater to an American buying public that wants extra stuff in their Bibles? Okay. So this is the John Brown one. This one is particularly infamous for this. So I'm going to scroll through here so that you can get a sense of what this looked like. This is all introductory information in the front of the Bible. I want to get to, so I mean, you're talking page after page after page of introduction to the text that is being added to a lot of these American printings before you even get to the actual biblical text. Okay? So here's that's still all introduction. Let's see if I can get more quickly through this. Okay, so here's the book of Numbers, right? So you have all this introduction to the book. You have introduction to the chapters, and this is all being written by Brown. This is not like trying to reproduce what the translators had to say. You've got chapter headings. You've got a bunch of stuff running down the columns on both sides of the page. And so once the text begins to be published in the United States, you start to see uniquely American editions emerging for the press in the United States. Okay, back to the notes. So this creates some scuttlebutt about how do we know that these things are accurate and true, and should we be doing this, and these sorts of things, right? So back to the notes. While the core text of these Bibles was the King James text of 1769 or something thereabouts, it was clear that publishers were already seeking to embellish their editions by adding ancillary material such as marginal notes, references, concordances, and the like. As a result, the subject was brought before the Congregational Ministers of Massachusetts at their annual convention in 1790. On 27 May 1790, the convention passed a resolution to be sent to Congress of the United States regarding regulating Bible printing in the Republic. The petition reads in part, quote, "To the Congress of the United States, a position requesting the attention of that honorable body to the subject of several impressions of the Bible now making, respecting the importance of accuracy in these imprints, and earnestly praying that they would take such a measure as the Constitution may permit, that no edition of the Bible or its translation be published in America without it being carefully inspected and certified to be free from error." Senate Journal, page 107. So are they concerned that the text is being published accurately in the United States? And you'll see this petition is dated from 1790. So we're talking within 7 years, roughly, of independence. This is already beginning to emerge as an issue. Okay? Next point. The petition was read in the United States Senate on June 10th, 1790, where it was immediately tabled for future consideration. In January 1791, the Baptist Associations of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Vermont also submitted petitions to Congress, quote, "to adopt measures to prevent the publication of any inaccurate editions of the Holy Bible." Later the same year, in December 1791, the First Amendment was ratified and added to the Constitution, which stated in part, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press." Okay? So thereafter, all such petitions regarding the regulation of Bible printing in the United States were not acted upon by Congress because they were viewed as clear violations of the First Amendment. So we have a unique situation emerging in the United States. Okay? We've declared our independence. We've ratified the Constitution. The Bill of Rights is signed in 1791. And so nothing ever comes of these petitions for Congress to regulate the publishing of the Bible on American shores, because it was interpreted now as a violation of the First Amendment. So, constitutional lawyers, etc., they could probably debate whether that's an accurate reading of the First Amendment and this and that till the cows come home, but the reality is, that's what happened. Okay? So, are we free at this point, are we free from the restrictions of the British Crown? Yes. Through the passing of the Constitution, the ratification of the Constitution and the passing of the Bill of Rights, is Congress going to do anything to regulate the printing of the King James Bible in the United States? So does this leave the door open now for American publishers to basically Americanize the text however they want? You guys understanding the frameworks that are leading to the situation that is going to emerge in the United States. Okay? So look at the last point there. Thus were the conditions created for the unregulated publication of the King James Bible in the United States. First, after the American Revolution, printers felt no compulsion to heed the British Crown's patent for printing the King James text. And second, on account of the First Amendment, the United States government took no steps to limit or regulate its publication. Consequently, it would not be long before Americanized editions of the King James text began to appear in the United States. So, does a distinctly American print culture emerge now for publishing the King James Bible on American shores? Okay? So I'll pause there. Does anybody have any questions or comments about that before we move on to the next point?
Just a surprise that 1791 was the first amendment introduced into the Constitution. I always thought the Constitution had
the Constitution was ratified later on. They added the Bill of Rights to the Constitution. So they were not passed and ratified at the same time. And if my memory is correct, I'm a little fuzzy on it. It's been a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that the promise of a Bill of Rights was part of what persuaded certain states to go ahead and pass the Constitution. Okay? Am I remembering that right? Yeah. So that was all part of the... Because remember, when independence is fought and secured, the first governing document was the Articles of Confederation. And that was deemed wholly insufficient to run the Republic, which led to the constitutional conventions, which led to, there's different plans presented, and that's where you get the bicameral legislature of the United States and all this sort of stuff, where they divide the Senate from the House, and one's based on proportional representation, the other one's based on equal representation, and all that stuff. To get that signed and ratified, there was the promise that we were going to add a Bill of Rights, and that came a few years later. Okay. Anybody else with a question or comment?
Those names that you mentioned.
The names of the printers?
Yeah. So were they? I mean, those weren't individuals that wanted to. Did they have to go through a publisher, or were they?
No, they were published. They were printers.
They
took it upon themselves to publish the text.
I would say because, like, I wanted to print my own Bible, and I went to a publisher, and that publisher looked at what I wanted to print and said, "No, we don't like it." But seeing that they were their own.
So go back to page 2.
They were their own publisher.
We're talking here about the first point under post-revolutionary King James Bibles. There were basically four different ones. Isaac Collins, Isaiah Thomas, Brown Self-Interpreting, and Hugh Gain. So here's what I can tell you. Isaac Collins, Isaiah Thomas, and Hugh Gain are individual publishers. The Brown Self-Interpreting Family Bible, or the Brown Family Folio, that was done by some other printer. The notes, the ancillary materials, the references, all that are Brown's notes. So in a sense, it's an early form of a Scofield reference Bible.
But if somebody, John Doe, came out and said, this is a Bible, and went to one of those guys, and they decided, hey, we don't like what we're seeing, then they would...
That would have been up to them to either accept or refuse it. Okay? The way I understand it. Any other questions or comments before we move on to the next point? Okay, the next point is Matthew Carey's Collation and Editions. Shortly after the turn of the century in 1801, Matthew Carey of Philadelphia printed a quarto edition of the King James Version. This was not Carey's first foray into Bible printing. Previously, in 1790, he printed 471 copies of the Catholic Douay-Rheims Bible. In preparation of the proof sheets of his 1801 edition of the King James, Carey conducted a collation comparing 18 editions, 4 from London, 3 Cambridge, 3 Oxford, 6 Edinburgh, and 2 American, those of Isaac Collins and Isaiah Thomas. Okay? That's from his own testimony. All right? After completing his collation, Carey identified 5 kinds of variants between the editions surveyed. 1 punctuation, 2, orthography or spelling. 3, the use of italics. 4, verbal differences without affecting the sense. And 5, variations in both words and sense. And that's from his published findings. Regarding orthographical variations, Carey wrote, quote, these are not as numerous as the former, but they are by no means inconsiderable. Among these that attracted most attention in the progress of the work were beside, towards, toward, among, amongst, valleys spelled V-A-L-L-I-E-S, valleys V-A-L-L-E-Y-S, champion spelled with the I-O-N versus champion spelled A-I-G-N, subtle without the E versus subtle with the E, diverse versus diverse, ought spelled A-U-G-H-T and ought O-U-G-H-T, born and born with an E at the end, and then et cetera, et cetera. Diverse and divers are miserably confounded together. They appear to be regarded as synonyms, which is an egregious error. Differs, diverse signifies many, diverse, different, and that's from Carey, page 232. So that's his opinion, okay? Lawrence M. Vance also discusses the work of Matthew Carey in his recently published work, The Text of the King James Bible. Carey's work from the early 19th century highlights the fact that variations in orthography between British editions, as well as between American editions and British printings, existed from very early in the print history of the King James Bible in the United States. Okay? Google Books has a digital copy of an 1813 edition of the King James published by Matthew Carey. According to Margaret T. Mills' book, we need to make this italics, Mike, the English Bible in America, that needs to be italics. Carey released 2 different editions in 1813 from standing type. Okay, now, let's stop there. So he publishes this in 1813, he publishes 2 different editions, and he does it from standing type. What does standing type mean? Something that's already laid out and in trades, ready to print. It's just waiting there, okay? Moving on. The first edition was printed in quarto size and contained 10 maps, 13 historical engravings, and Brown's Concordance. In contrast, the second 1813 edition, printed by Carey, did not contain these ancillary materials and answers to Carey's duodecimo edition from 1802-1803. Hills further reports that Matthew Carey's 1802-1803 duodecimo edition contained an order of books for the Old and New Testaments, as well as an account of dates that preceded the Old Testament text. A table of kindred, in addition to a table of time, was also included following the Old Testament. Last, a table of offices followed the New Testament. Now, this is why this is important. Therefore, the 1813 King James Bible furnished by Google Books answers to the 1802-1803 edition of Matthew Carey, seeing that it was reprinted in 1813 from identical standing type. So that means that those two are exactly the same because they were printed from the same one. The same standing type. Now this is where it gets even more interesting. According to Margaret Mills, in about 1803, Carey published the standing type used to produce his duodecimo from Hugh Gain, who had also printed a duodecimo edition in 1792. So now this takes us back 10 years before that. Okay? So follow the progression. 1813, Matthew Carey publishes an edition. His edition from 1813 matches his editions from 1802-1803 because they were published from the same set of what? Standing type. In 1802, Matthew Carey had purchased the standing type that Hugh Gain had used 10 years before that in 1792. Okay? So 1792, 1802, 1813, are they all being printed from the same type? The same standing type. Is everybody following that? Okay, back to the notes. Okay? So, according to Margaret Mills, in about 1803, Carey published the standing type used to produce his duodecimo from printer Hugh Gain, who also printed a duodecimo edition in 1792. A comparison between Gain's duodecimo, 1792, And Terry's 1803 reveals that they are identical in terms of their preliminary and ancillary editions. Both editions include an order of books and an account of dates before the Old Testament and a table of kindred and a table of time following it. Moreover, both editions included a table of offices at the end of the New Testament. The only major difference is that Carey did not include the Apocrypha in his duodecimo, whereas Hugh Gain did. So is everything else for the Old Testament proper and the New Testament proper the same? Is everybody with me? Okay? Therefore, the form of the King James text exhibited by Carey's 1813 duodecimo printing answers to and is identical to his 1802-03 text, since they were both produced using the same standing type. Furthermore, given the fact that Carey purchased the standing type used to print his 1802-03 edition from Gaines, who used it to produce his 1792 decimo, the form of the text exhibited by Carey's 1802-03 and 1813 editions represents a form of the text, a form of the King James text in America that dates from 1792, within 15 years of the advent of Bible printing in this country. Now, I know that's a lot to track with, but does everybody understand that basic progression? So in 1792, Hugh Gain publishes a text. He keeps the type standing in a warehouse somewhere. It's a lot of type to have wrapped up in a Bible. He then sells that type to Matthew Carey in 1802. Matthew Carey uses it to publish an edition in 1802 and then again in 1803. These are identical editions because they're printed from the same standing what? Type. Is everybody with that? Okay? So, an examination of the Gain, now I'm going to call it the Gain-Carey text, and the reason I'm calling it that is because Carey is using the same type that Gain typeset in 1792. An examination of the Gain-Carey text reveals the existence of orthographical variants in the King James text from the inception of its printing on American shores. Now stop there. Did I already show you, by looking at screenshots from Aiken's Bible from 1782, that the very first Bible printed on American shores already had orthographical changes in it, with established and established? All right? So back to the notes. An examination of the Gain-Carey text reveals the existence of orthographical variants in the King James text from the inception of its printing on American shores. Please consider the following evidence of orthographical changes in early American printings of the King James Bible. So look at page 5. Okay? So, this is this column, we've got the passage on the left. In the center, we have the standard 1769 spelling of the word. And then we have the Gain-Carey text from 1792, 1803, and 1813. And notice what is already happening, right? In these three occasions here, do we have orthographical difference between establish and establish? Okay? In 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 6, it has end sample. That's already changed to what?
Example.
And then we got a bunch of occurrences here, starting in Genesis chapter 11, verse 3, and running through 2 Timothy 3:17, where the standard 1769 text has truly, but the American text has what?
Thoroughly.
Okay? So here's the point. Independence is secured right around 1782, 83. Aiken publishes the first complete Bible in 1782. 10 years later, with Hugh Gain in 1792, do we already have American printings that are exhibiting orthographical change to conform the text to the way these words were being spelled in North America? In America, is everybody following this? Okay. So underneath the table, the facts presented in this table prove that spelling changes such as these are not, quote, a new attack on the King James Bible, as has been asserted by local church Bible publishers and other King James-only proponents. So a couple weeks ago, I showed you this little monograph here. This is put out by local church Bible publishers. This belongs to Nate. He's letting me borrow it, where they talk about some of these words, and they frame these up as an attack on the King James Bible by modern printers. So, for example, Some people have Bibles printed by Thomas Nelson that change thoroughly to thoroughly. Okay? Local Church Bible Publishers calls that an attack on the King James Bible in this monograph. What they don't know, when they wrote this, sometime in the last, this is not dated, but sometime in the last, I'm going to say 20, 25 years, is that were American editions already making those changes back to the earliest ones that were published on American shores. So if these guys, if the logic that they set forth in this monograph is true, then are all of these old King James Bibles published in North America all corruptions? Because they are spelling the words differently than the British printings. I'm sorry, but that is too much for me. That is way too much for me. Because what that means then is these Bibles that I brought in here that I showed you last week, this one's from 1829 and it spells words differently. That means any American that is reading this Bible in 1829 and is reading these things with American spellings, they're reading a corrupt Bible according to this line of logic. That is too much for me to support. I can't logically go there. And what this would mean then is that you would logically have to falsify thousands of King James Bibles printed in North America because they just don't have, because they have different what?
Spellings.
Okay? Back to this point. The facts presented on the table prove, that spelling changes such as these are not a, quote, new attack on the King James Bible, as has been asserted by local church Bible publishers and other King James-only proponents. Rather, orthographical variations in American printings of the King James Bible are as old as the printed history of the text in the United States. I can show you this, I can document this within 10 years of the formation of the Republic. Okay? So they're as old as the printed history of the text in the United States. Were Gain and Carey seeking to, quote, corrupt the text? Before answering, please bear in mind that during this time period in question, 1792 through 1813, there was no such thing as a modern version. There was no textual debate. The critical text of Westcott and Hort had not even been developed. Codex Sinaiticus, 1844, had not even been discovered yet. If corruption was the goal, there were certainly more effective measures that could have been taken to undermine the veracity of the text than to change the spellings of these words. Does everybody understand what I'm getting at? Okay? Moreover, as part one of this book established, I'm referring there to this book that I wrote, The King James Bible in America. Moreover, as part one of this book established, there is no substantive difference in meaning between the various spellings of these words to begin with. Are establish and establish meaning the same thing? Are end sample and example meaning the same thing? Are all way and all ways meaning the same thing? Okay? I talk about it in the book. I got a series of videos defending this book when it was critiqued by a pastor in Connecticut back in the year 2000. And no one has furnished any evidence to me that would suggest that any of that is false or inaccurate information. So, what is my point? From the earliest stages of the text being published in America, does it show evidence of being conformed to American spelling? If those are corruptions, then do we literally have to throw out nearly an entire century's worth of American published King James Bibles? Because they possessed American spellings.
Just a further trace down that alley. If they interpreted, or if they republished the King James from that period into like a German version, did they have to keep the, because what I remember from German is they often changed the tenses around just to the way they spoke.
So different languages work different, of course, right?
Yeah.
Verb order, verb subject.
Have to keep the same.
If you're translating into German,
tense as, you know, if he said, it one way, did they have to, you know, do it exactly the same tenses in the German version, or is that a correction of it just changing the tenses even?
So I'm going to answer that question to the best of my knowledge.
I'm just curious.
Spanish has different order.
Yep.
So in order for Spanish to make sense, you have to follow the subject-verb order of Spanish.
Okay.
So that would seem to me to be understood that a Spanish Bible is gonna it can communicate the exact same substance,
yeah.
But is it going to be verbatim identical to an English Bible?
No.
No, it's not possible because of the way Spanish works, the way Italian works, the way, you know, so on and so forth. Okay, so you can have verbal equivalence and substantive doctrinal agreement, but you're not going to have verbatim identical wording because of the way the two languages work different.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's a subtle difference, but very similar to the way we're addressing the English.
It's sort of related, and then I assume I don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
So I got to caveat this. Other languages probably have multiple different spellings and probably went through the same sort of things that English went through, just as a part of language development. Okay. So, is everybody with me so far? Any other questions? So up to this point, if you wanted to publish something, you had to typeset everything by hand. Okay, which then leads us into our next point, the impact of stereotyping and the American Bible Society. Now, by stereotyping here, we're not talking about like social cultural stereotyping. We're talking about a new technology for printing. Okay, so look at point number one. The execution of Carey's strategy of maintaining standing type for various sized editions required an entire room to house the preset blocks for a single edition. While it was still cheaper than typesetting an edition from scratch for each printing, it remained a costly enterprise to house all of the standing type necessary to print multiple editions. In the early 19th century, a new method of typesetting was introduced called stereotyping. Stereotyping plates of type were made from plaster of Paris that allowed printers to print certain works without having to reset the type every time or keep large volumes of loose typeset standing in molds. This process arrived in the United States in 1812 and was immediately applied to the Bible printing industry. So here's my understanding of this, okay? You could lay out the type for a page. You could then take a cast of that using plaster of Paris in some fashion and now make a plate. So now the next time I want to print that, I have a preset plate, it's thin, it takes up way more space, and I don't have to allocate a bunch of standing type for it, okay? So now can I mass produce a page of biblical text without having to reset the type every time I want to print it? Does everybody understand that? Okay, so this is a new technology that's coming in the early 19th century that is now going to be applied to the printing of Bibles. Eric, you look confused. Do you have a question?
No.
Okay. So, in 1812, the Philadelphia Bible Society acquired stereotype plates from England, from which they printed the first stereotyped book in America. By 1815, publishers were using American-made stereotype plates to print Bibles in this country. So that means the typeset had been laid out in America, the cast had been made, and the plates had been made on American shores, not foreign, okay? So by 1815, publishers were using American-made stereotype plates to print the Bible in this country. 5 years later, in 1820, now listen to this statistic, 50% of American Bible editions declared their stereotype status on the title page. So they would say, stereotyped, okay? Stereotyping revolutionized American book publishing in this first third of the 19th century, and no book was so radically touched by this revelation as the Bible. So what becomes the most stereotyped book in America? The Bible. Okay, so let me see. Cover's falling off this thing. I can't remember. Yep. So here's this 1829 Bible. Okay. Down here, it says, an alphabetical table, all the names in the Old and New Testament with their signification, and then it says with plates. Okay? So I take that to mean that this is published from what? Stereotyping, stereotype plates.
That might mean the photo for illustration.
Could mean that too, you're right, that's fair. But I'll show you in a minute from 1819, I think, where it explicitly says that on an American printing, okay? So the advent of stereotyping and the formation of the American Bible Society forever changed the production of Bibles in the United States. The American Bible Society sought to utilize the new technology of stereotyping to fulfill the ambitious goal of providing a Bible for every household in America. So once they get these stereotype plates done, can they just print and print and print? Okay? Look at the...
You missed
the paragraph. I did? Where? Oh. Let's back up, I'm sorry. The formation of Bible societies as non-commercial printers and distributors of the text also appeared in the early 19th century. In the United States, the Philadelphia Bible Society was the first to organize in 1808 after the model of the British and Foreign Bible Society founded in London in 1804. Soon after, many other local societies were formed around the country, buying their Bibles from local publishers. Given the need for the production of inexpensive Bibles as the country expanded westward, the local societies decided to combine their efforts in 1816 and form the American Bible Society. Thank you for pointing that out, Eric. The advent of stereotyping and the formation of the American Bible Society forever changed the production of Bibles in the United States. The American Bible Society sought to utilize the new technology of stereotyping to fulfill the ambitious goal of providing a Bible for every household in America. Quote, no publisher more enthusiastically embraced it. The society adopted a vision of encouraging the widest possible circulation of the Holy Scriptures without note or comment. So in other words, without what? Without extra stuff, just raw biblical text, right? So central was stereotyping to this vision that the society initially advertised a mission of providing, quote, a sufficiency of well-printed and accurate editions of the Scriptures, but also to furnish great districts of the American continent with well-executed stereotype plates for their deep and extensive diffusion throughout regions, which are now scarcely supplied at discouraging expense. So in other words, they have a vision to make the Bible readily available in every American household, no matter where you lived. If you lived on the frontier in the early 1800s, or if you lived in New York or Boston, they wanted the Bible to be available. By 1820, the society possessed, here it is, 10 different sets of stereotype plates capable of producing 5 different types of King James Bibles and New Testaments. In this regard, the American Bible Society was trend-setting. The first large publishing house to adopt stereotyping was Harper Brothers, and they did not do so until the 1830s. A normal run for a commercial printer in the 1820s was around 2,000 copies. In contrast, the society printed 20,000 copies of a stereotype Bible in 1816, and by 1830 was producing 300,000 copies a year. Now, that's by 1830. So then you go to 1840, 1850, 1860, 1870, the American Bible Society producing millions of Bibles over the span of the 19th century. And these millions of Bibles, King James Bibles, with American spellings, going all through the United States, and our American missionaries taking these Bibles with them around the world to other parts of the world and foreign lands. Okay? But all of those Bibles would be corrupt, according to the argumentation of local church Bible publishers, if what they're saying is correct, because they don't spell words the same way the British ones spell words. Now listen to me. King James advocates, they will often quote and cite as a talking point in their argumentation the nearly, I don't know the exact number, hundreds of millions, if not billions of editions of the King James Bible that have been published since 1611 and gone all through the world by Anglo-American missionaries. Okay? A large chunk of those Bibles are American Bible Society Bibles published in the United States using industrialized methods. If you now are going to say that those are illegitimate Bibles because they were published in America with American spellings, your number of King James Bibles, is it going to be dwindled significantly by having to remove all of these from the market? as being able to be counted because they don't meet your spelling standards. Okay? So, did I finish that point? Are we on orthography in the ABS text now?
Yeah.
Okay. So, as the practice of stereotyping expanded, the production of the King James Bible in America, the number of orthographic variants also increased, given that there was no uniformity of spelling in the different sets of stereotype plates. So let's go back up to the previous point. Okay? By 1820, the society possessed 10 different sets of stereotype plates capable of producing 5 different types of Bibles and New Testaments. All the spelling on all those plates is not uniform. It's not. I'm sorry to say. So that means are they putting gobs of Bibles into the market, gobs of King James Bibles into the markets that have variations from each other as far as spelling of words? That's not even to mention all the local publishing houses or other people that are publishing the text. So back to this point. As the practice of stereotyping expanded, the production of the King James Bible in America, the number of orthographic variants also increased, given that there was no uniformity of spelling in the different sets of stereotypes plates produced. Once again, Google Books has a copy of an American Bible Society stereotype text from 1819. So let me show you that. So here's the text. Okay? You scroll down. Former translations, New York, published by the American Bible Society, and here it is, stereotyped. So this is an 1819 printing from stereotype plates, published in New York by the American Bible Society. Okay? Back to the notes. This particular edition was stereotyped by E.G. White for the American Bible Society and printed by D. Fanshaw of New York. According to the bibliographic information provided by Margaret T. Mills, it is a reprint of the Society's 1816 duodecimo size Bible. Both the 1816 and 1819 printings contain minimal ancillary additions. Only an order of books in the front and tables of scripture, measures, weights, money, and time have been added following the Old Testament. Therefore, the 1819 edition of the American Bible Society text was printed using the same stereotype plates as the 1816 edition, the very first one printed by the Society. So this one here from 1819, you can see, is the same. So this one is M378 in the catalog, in Margaret Mills' catalog. It's the exact same as M302, which is from 1816. So these are exactly the same. This one from 1819 is the exact same as the one from 1816, the first one the Society published. You guys with me? Back to the notes. We finished that point, right? So, top of page 7. An examination of the American Bible Society text from 1816 reveals further changes in orthography to the King James text from the Gaine-Terry text of 1792, 1803, and 1813 noted above. Concerning the pairs of words we have been comparing throughout the book, that's again the book here, the King James Bible in America, thoroughly, thoroughly, always, and sample, example, and establish, it is important to note that only the word and samples remains unchanged in the ABS text of 1816 when compared against the standard British text of 1769. As the next section illustrates, and I'm going to give you the screenshots here in a second, in every occurrence where the words truly, always, and established occurs in Scripture, the American Bible Society edition of 1816 has updated the orthography to reflect contemporary American conventions in the early 19th century. Is everybody with me? Okay? So, every time truly, always, and established, they change it, the spelling, to match, to be, that they change truly to what? Thoroughly, always to what? Always, and established to what? Established. Okay? So in order to ascertain the extent of the orthographical changes, I have conducted a comparison between the list of spelling changes identified by local church Bible publishers in their booklet, Have You Seen Some of the Changes That Publishers Are Making in your King James Bible. And that is, again, this monograph right here that I borrowed from Nate. Okay? So I took that. So let me restart that over again. In order to ascertain the extent of the orthographical changes, I have conducted a comparison between the list of spelling changes identified by local church Bible publishers in their booklet, Have You Seen Some Changes, Some of the Changes That Publishers Are Making in Your King James Bible, and the King James text of the American Bible Society in 1816. The results of this comparison are presented in the following table. An asterisk indicates that an entry was added by the author. That's me. Please note that a blank in the ABS 1816 convention column indicates that it utilized the same spelling as the standard 1769 text. So let's look at some of this, okay? So, here's the standard 1769 spelling convention afterwards with an S. The ABS text from 1816, it read the same. But the modern spelling convention is what? Afterward. Alright? I already mentioned this one. Alway occurs in the 1769 spelling. The ABS 1816 text already changes it to what? Always. Okay? So there's some here. Armor, spelled the same. We're not going to read every single one of them. We'll just kind of look at some of the ones that have changes. Assuaged, spelled one way. Assuaged is changed in 1816 to the way that we're more familiar with it now. Astonished, I guess, is this word, right? That's changed. So we've got the spelling of Balak. We've got basins. Behooved. Now look at brazen. Okay, so here we have this issue with, should it be an S or should it be what?
Z.
Alright, American spelling in 1816 had already changed it. Okay, broided is changed to broidered. Okay, caterpillar is changed. No, it's not caterpillar. Yeah, caterpillar is changed to caterpillar, I guess. So, you know, you've got cloak is changed. What's that? Ditched is changed. Inquire with an E versus inquire with an I is changed. Forbad is changed. Add an E at the end. Grizzled versus grizzled. Heretic is spelled different with a CK at the end versus no K at the end. Go to the next page, page 9. Entreat is spelled different. Jubilee. Loathed. Mortar. Music. Public. Recompense is spelled two different ways in the text at the time. Repaid is spelled different. Okay, go to page 10. You can see I've added establish and establish there, steadfast, subtle, sycamore is spelled different, thoroughly, truly, traffic, today is hyphenated, tomorrow is hyphenated, underneath that you got wine fat, and then wine fat is hyphenated, so you got quite the list there. Go to page 11. We gotta be close to being done, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, the preceding tables contain a total of 100 words. Okay? 95 of which were identified by local church Bible publishers and 5 that were added by me. Of these 100 words that are spelled differently in modern printings of the King James Bible, 37 of them, or 37%, had already experienced orthographical changes in American printings of the King James Bible by 1816. That is a large number. Okay? In addition, another 16 words in modern printings exhibit a difference of only one letter. In these 17 cases, why do I have 16 words and then 17 cases? I'm not sure. I don't remember why I did that. It's got to be a reason.
It must be 16.
Yeah.
You can check.
Circle that. So in these cases, the letter U was removed from words like labor so that the word reads labor without the U. Okay? On pages 234 and 235 of the text of the King James Bible, Dr. Lawrence M. Vance catalogs American spellings in ABS printings from the 20th century, from a 1974 edition. Do they continue to have different spellings? So what we're looking at here is the very first one from 1816. 37% of the 100 words we looked at had already been changed in the way they were spelled. Okay? Next point. Many King James Bible believers utilize Noah Webster's American Dictionary of the English Language as an authority for defining English words found in the King James Bible. The Pro King James website, the King James Bible page, contains a KJV dictionary among its many useful and informative resources. The KJV dictionary was created using Noah Webster's dictionary to define the English words found in the King James Bible. It is important for King James advocates who utilize Noah Webster's dictionary to realize that it is, quote, an American dictionary of the English language. It's not a British dictionary, it's an American one. Dictionary. In other words, Webster is informing his readers how English words were used and spelled in America. If one were to take the above list of 100 words and search the standard 1769 spelling convention, the British spelling, in Webster's 1828 dictionary, they would not find an entry for many of the words. Because they're spelled what? Different in America. For example, if one searched heretic with a K, they would not find an entry. Conversely, if one were to search heretic with the C at the end, they would encounter various meanings of the word. When one compares American printings of the King James Bible against Noah Webster's American Dictionary, they will see that the spelling changes in American King James Bibles coincide with how English words were being spelled where? In America. When afforded the opportunity, now here's where you got to put this all together, right? When afforded the opportunity, due to the lack of copyright and congressional oversight in terms of Bible printing, American publishers Americanized the text by continuing to update the orthography to suit their American readership. How is this any different from what occurred in the King James text between 1611 and 1769? Did the same thing happen in Britain with the standardization of their text and the updating of their spelling? Hello. Thus, America's print culture gave birth to distinctly American editions of the King James Bible from very early in the life of the nation without altering the doctrinal content of the text. I'm sorry, I am totally unpersuaded that if you spell these words with the American spelling, you have corrupted the Bible and altered the text. I'm unconvinced, because the words mean the same one. The same thing. But here's where if you dogmatize on a special edition, a certain edition, that has to have every jot and tittle perfect to your standard, then you have to logically falsify and throw out any edition that does not conform to that standard. I see no logical reason, I see no theological reason, I see no practical reason for doing that, because the implications upon the American Bible reading public in the 19th century would be absolutely catastrophic if we adopted this thinking and back applied it to people from two centuries ago.
What's the standard in that little
pamphlet? Oh, that's, I think, Oxford or Cambridge.
1769?
Yes. So back to the notes. Thus, America's print culture gave birth to distinctly American editions of the King James Bible from very early in the life of the nation, without altering the doctrinal content of the text. Over the course of the 19th century, as more American editions were produced, further Americanizing of spelling occurred and continued without any uniformity across the printed editions in the United States. Okay? So once again, the facts covered in this section bear out that American editions of the King James Bible were changing the orthography to reflect American conventions well before the textual and translational controversies of the latter 19th century. By 1820, the American Bible Society was using 10 different sets of stereotype plates to produce at least 5 different sized Bibles. Yet even these plates contained spelling variants. What is more is that when one considers the sheer number of editions of the King James Bible published on American shores between 1782 and 1881, one will search in vain for any two that are identical in their orthography throughout. So, this is where I'm at. Like, if we are going to adopt extreme standards on these things, we have to be ready to live with the implications of these standards upon what actually exists. Okay, Bart.
Was the American Bible Association sort of the authority to make sure that it was basically...
Next week we'll talk a little bit about in the middle of the century they did have a couple meetings to try to standardize the American printings and I mean they did improve it a little bit, but it never was a standardly published text in North America. But again, the Congress doesn't do anything because of the First Amendment, and so you end up with this sort of wildcat print situation. But the thing is all of these are King James Bibles. They all have the long ending of Mark. They all have the woman taken in adultery. They all have Acts 8:37. They have all this stuff. They're just spelling the words using American spelling. Okay.
And in my experience, it's usually even more local. Like the pastors would emphasize one variation over another, just to keep it, you know, in context with the rest of the church. But they would also, you know, be the ones, I would think, to, you know, criticize any edition that wasn't at least biblically accurate.
Yeah, and there are examples of people whining about the spelling, and you know, I mean, there were people that whined about that stuff, but it was not the thing that has been made today by King James only advocates in the late 20th, early 21st century.
Yeah.
Okay, but we're at the meter here. We got to quit. Back to 2 minutes over already.
When was that little pamphlet made?
This is undated, unfortunately.
Is the position they're trying to push is that this is more of a more recent thing?
They are trying to put, yes, they are wholly unaware of the print history of the text in the United States. So the stuff that I've covered in this lesson and in this book, the people that wrote this are totally unaware of.
So they're complaining about stuff.
They're complaining about stuff that was a reality in the United States from 1792 onward. It's absurd and ridiculous to me.
And they obviously have never read the preface to the original 1611 King James Bible.
Maybe they have, maybe they haven't. But if they have, they haven't really thought through what it totally means for this greater conversation.